Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. We have a great show for you today. First, no cameras for the public in the Richard Allen Delphi murder case. We have the George Kelly verdict watch. The hush money trial commenced this morning with the opening statements and one witness before they recess for a juror's dental appointment in the case of the people of the state of New York versus Donald Trump. Adam Montgomery will be at his sentencing. After all, wouldn't an innocent man want to be there? What have I been saying all along about people harming kids? Well, it's nice to hear someone else say it as well. And there is now no privacy interest on your phone, according to the Ninth Circuit. We got a guy who killed his wife. Well, guess what? He lost his appeal. And our dumb criminal of the day. And you have to admit it when a dumb criminal says, well, that would be dumb, and that's how you go to jail. Let's talk about it.
Hi, lawyer. Lawyer. Lawyer.
Good day, everyone. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Thanks for joining us. You know the drill. Subscribe if you haven't. Like if you do. Leave me a comment below and hit that little bell for notifications. Now, remember, you can also listen to us anytime on any of your favorite podcasting apps. Hope you all had a great weekend. It's going to be a busy court week indeed. So let's go ahead and get to the docket for April 22nd, 2024. And first on the docket, guess what? Denied. You don't deserve it. You don't have a right to know. The judge in the case of Richard Allen, you know, the Delphi homicide suspect, the man accused of killing 13-year-old Abigail Williams and 14-year-old Libby German, there in Delphi, Indiana. That's right. The judge has denied yet another television station's request to have cameras in the courtroom for the trial that is going to begin next month. So Special Judge Francis C. Gull rejected a request from a local channel in Indianapolis, which obviously makes it highly unlikely that there will be cameras allowed in probably one of the most high-profile criminal trials in the history of Indiana, at least in decades at least. Like I said, that trial was supposed to begin on May 13th. Now, the court's denial of television cameras is now the judge's fourth time that she has denied television cameras access to the court. The judge had previously rejected requests from a news channel in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and then another channel in Indianapolis, as well as two others from Fort Wayne as well. So that makes four, five total. Gee, Judge, what are you doing? Anyway, Judge Gull has only allowed cameras to access one of Mr. Allen's courtroom's hearing. That was back on October 19th when several TV stations worked together to have Court TV provide a pooled camera coverage for all participating broadcasters. Judge Gull then denied the courtroom cameras for the October 31st hearing, and the court docket cites unauthorized filming and broadcasting of pre-hearing activities in the courtroom at the October 19 hearing as the reason. Now, the courtroom camera requests from News Nation, Law and Crime, Court TV, as well as the local channels were all denied. Now, in late March, Judge Gull denied an email request from an Indiana lawyer to discuss what comes into play when deciding whether she would allow cameras in the courtroom. She did not immediately respond to the follow-up email asking if she would accept any media outlet's request to put cameras in the courtroom for Mr. Allen's trial. Why the secrecy? I mean, I get it. There's a difference between privacy and secrecy. And when things are done in secret, it's because you're probably doing bad things and you don't want other people to know what's taking place. Is that why, Judge? I don't know. This is the biggest case in Indiana. This was an unsolved cold case. Defendant has allegedly confessed. Those issues will be coming in. There's allegations of this other occult. There's questions as to the fairness of the judge. You would think the judge would say, hey, you think I'm being unfair? I'll let you see the evidence that comes in, and you decide if I was being unfair, if I was being ridiculous in my orders where I denied everything from the defense. Maybe the prosecution's evidence is so overwhelming. Wouldn't you like to see that, ladies and gentlemen? Don't you think the judge should allow that to take place? I'm a firm believer that our courtrooms should be open to everyone all the time. And as long as you don't disrupt, like I said, I believe that there should be a video feed to every courtroom. And if you're watching the morning docket on a Monday morning and motions in the afternoon, you should be able to see that, ladies and gentlemen. And I understand an open courtroom simply means that somebody can come in and watch. But it also comes down to fundamental fairness so that the world can see in big cases. And remember, we've had lots of cases over the years where people thought someone was guilty. And when you heard all the evidence, you thought, oh, I guess I see how somebody could have come to that conclusion. What comes to mind is obviously the Kyle Rittenhouse case. I was like, oh, this guy's toast, right? The evidence comes out, the kind of modifying of the video that was sent out, the self-defense, how he was attacked, whether you like him or not, the point is everybody got to see. And there wasn't rioting and burning of the city as people had predicted because they got to see the evidence. An open society means things are open to the public, not just what the gatekeepers think that we can handle. I don't know. Maybe we're going to have to start a letter writing campaign to the judge. I'm not sure. Next, George Kelly. We are on jury watch. Well, the jury could not reach a verdict in the George Allen Kelly trial last Friday, which means that they came back to deliberate today. Now, the Santa Cruz rancher is accused of killing a migrant on the property, and the jury began deliberating mid-afternoon Thursday after about 4 weeks of testimony. The jury deliberated for about 7.5 hours on Friday for a total of about 8 hours and 45 minutes over those 2 days without reaching a verdict. At about 2 p.m. local time there in Arizona, the 8-person jury declared they were at an impasse, but the judge asked them to continue their deliberations and gave them an option for breaking early for the day. They requested police reports about 30 minutes after being asked to resume deliberations and were advised that they had all the evidence that they needed. The jurors were beginning their deliberations today. Now, like I said, it's not in dispute whether George Allen Kelly stepped out on his patio and fired 9 shots from the AK-47 across his ranch land. He said he heard a gunshot, saw armed men on his ranch, and fired over the heads to scare them away. What is in dispute was whether one of the shots hit and killed the migrant. Another man said he and the migrant were trying to avoid Border Patrol and were running back towards Mexico when he heard shots and the migrant fell with a gunshot wound. Now, the bullet went through the migrant and kept going, and it was never recovered for any forensic match to Kelly's gun. Now, Kelly's attorney suggested the victim died sometime after Kelly fired his shots and the border bandits were the real killers so they could steal drugs and money from the migrant. But prosecutors say that Kelly gave conflicting statements about how many intruders there were and whether they had guns or not. And when asked why Kelly never told detectives he had even fired his gun until a half hour into the interrogation, Kelly's defense argued that he was stressed and fearful, not evasive, and that he told a Border Patrol agent he had fired shots and thought that the agents shared that with the other investigators. So, ladies and gentlemen, what happens when a judge is told by the jury that they're in an impasse? They cannot reach a unanimous decision. Judge doesn't want to declare a mistrial because at that point, guess what? They got to retry the case all over again, assuming the prosecution wants to do that. So the judge will oftentimes give them what they refer to as an Allen instruction or a modified Allen instruction. It comes from a case. And it basically says, hey, I understand you're at an impasse, but go back, look at the evidence, be willing to say that maybe I was wrong in my interpretation, but don't just change your mind just to change your mind. If you're truly convinced that whether the person is guilty or innocent, you shouldn't do that, but to take the opportunity to reevaluate where you are coming from. Normally, if the jury comes back after that and says we cannot reach an agreement as to the verdicts, then normally the judge will declare a mistrial, but not up until the point where he wants to do it. Remember, this was a 4-week trial at great time and expense to all parties involved, including the jury. But hopefully, they don't just crumble if they're truly persuaded one way or the other. I always ask in voir dire, ladies and gentlemen, if you're back there deliberating and it is 11 to 1, either way, guilty or not guilty, doesn't matter, but would you be willing to change your mind just so you could go home? And most people always say, well, no, I'm not going to do that. So we'll see if somebody changes their mind. We have a verdict watch set up, or we're prepared to watch it. So when it comes in, we will bring it to you live. Next on the docket, a historic case, a former president on trial. That's right, the case of Donald Trump. The hush money trial was kicked off in Manhattan with opening statements and could end with the testimony of the first witness. Now, prosecutors laid out what the former president's scheme to corrupt the 2016 election with a catch-and-kill plot. Now, Trump's legal team then insisted that there was nothing wrong with trying to influence an election and criticized the credibility of Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels. The first witness was called, and that's the National Enquirer publisher David Pecker. And they didn't get too far into his testimony and basically wrapped up the proceedings for the day. Why, you may ask? Well, that's because one of the jurors had a dental appointment. Now, as you may recall, the judge won't allow former President Trump to go to his son's high school graduation in Florida, which I think is this Friday, because the show must go on. But we took an early day for a juror's dental appointment, and there's no court on Wednesday because the judge apparently participates in some sort of charitable donation of his time, and therefore he must attend that. So really, we're off to a booming start. Anyway, Mr. Pecker did tell the court before they were so rudely interrupted that he had the final say on big stories involving celebrities, and he walked through the process of picking the magazine cover. He also explained to the jury how they used checkbook journalism to pay for stories and how he had a private email to hide certain communications with his assistant. Now, the executive is a central figure in the case after he alerted President Trump's lawyer, then Michael Cohen, about Stormy Daniels and her plan to reveal her claims of an alleged affair with the former president back in 2006. Pecker alerted Trump in October of 2016 of the Daniels affair allegation, but she ultimately settled for $130,000 in this non-disclosure deal with the attorney Michael Cohen. So really what this amounts to is the prosecution is saying this is election interference. Donald Trump's attorneys are saying, well, it is election interference, but guess what? It's not illegal. The hush money was paid by Michael Cohen. And hush money, settlement, whatever you want to call it. People enter into settlement agreements all the time, and they paid it. The attorney, Michael Cohen, then billed the Trump organization, and they expensed it as legal fees, and the payments were made 32 times or 34 times, hence the 34 charges. Counting error, something along those lines. Now, remember, the Federal Elections Commission was aware of this, looked into this, decided not to pursue the case in any way. Now, another example comes to mind in this particular case was Hillary Clinton. She paid for the dossier as it related to President Trump back in the 2016 election. And guess what? She had a law firm pay for it, so she didn't have her hands on it. And the Federal Election Commission gave Hillary Clinton, then candidate Hillary Clinton, a big fat fine. So we'll bring you the facts as they come in. You decide, let the chips fall where they may. I'm sure someone will say, oh my gosh, Scott, you didn't say this. You're anti-Trump. Oh my God, Scott, you said this. You are pro-Trump. Nope, we're just bringing it to you the way we see it. Generally, I have a general despise for all politicians because, well, they're all liars. They have one job, which is to loot the treasury. I guess two jobs. Politicians have two jobs, to loot the treasury and enrich their friends. So therefore, we don't have any loyalty to any of them. Next, Adam Montgomery. Remember him? That's right. The guy that killed his daughter, didn't really find her, went to trial, didn't want to go to court at all because, he didn't have to, and the judge allowed it. Well, the judge in the Adam Montgomery case has denied the now convicted killer's request to not appear at his sentencing hearing next month. Like I said, a jury found Adam Montgomery guilty in March of beating Harmony Montgomery to death because she soiled herself. Now, he didn't show up in court for most of the trial or the deliberations that took about 6 hours before they returned a guilty verdict on the charge of second-degree murder, second-degree assault, falsifying evidence, abuse of a corpse, and tampering with witness. Anyway, Mr. Montgomery asked that he be excused for the sentencing hearing, and the state obviously said no, he should appear. The judge, who allowed him not to show up for his trial all the way through, which I think is absolutely appalling, because I'm sure on his appeal, he's going to say, I wasn't at the critical stage of the proceedings, the trial, to assist my attorneys, and therefore I was found guilty and I need a new trial. Mark my words, I'm sure he'll go there. Anyway, the judge noted that the only factual basis that Mr. Montgomery gave for missing the sentencing is, wait for it, that's right, he says that he's innocent. So why would he want to go? Well, you would think if you were innocent, you'd want to go to your trial. Anyway, the court said, hey, Mr. Montgomery has been found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt by a jury to all of the charges. He asserts no other factual basis for the excusal. So, under New Hampshire law, it requires that the defendant be present when the victim or victim's next of kin address the court, and Harmony's relatives intend to deliver their victim impact statements. That is set for May 9th, and yes, Adam Montgomery should be there to hear about the harm that has been caused to them, and you would think him for killing his own daughter, but I know he didn't do it according to him. Even though he had every opportunity to show otherwise, he did not. Next, now remember how I always say, I love my kids, but I don't necessarily want to hang out with other people's kids, right? Just the way it is, right? And I've been saying it that all these people that want to do harm to other kids in the world, they're weirdos, freaks, and why are they there? Why does the guy want to be the volleyball coach? Why does he want to be the girls' swim coach? Why is the coach taking all the boys on trips and they're going to stay in the same room, right? Just stuff that should make everybody's spidey senses tingle. And I've always said, well, of course they're there, right? Because that's where the kids are. So it's nice to hear somebody else that basically says, hey, Scott at Crime Talk was correct. Now, did Bill Maher actually say Scott was correct? No, but it's what Scott at Crime Talk has been saying for a long time. So think about it, ladies and gentlemen. Bill Maher, if you haven't seen it, it is worth listening to. He talks about the documentary as it related to Nickelodeon, Quiet on the Set, and that basically how these kids were abused sexually. And, oh, by the way, there's lots of people that were associated with that are true sex offenders. And he basically says, well, of course they're there because that's where the kids are, just like Scott says it as well. And he did note that it would seem like no one's I also found it funny in his monologue that he says that he has no kids, but it seems like he's the only one with no kids are the people that are actually looking out for other children's protection. So it doesn't take one to figure out that these people hanging around kids are there because, well, they want to be with kids. Be careful, ladies and gentlemen. And like I said, that little spot where he says, of course they're there. That's where the kids are. Who's been saying that for years, ladies and gentlemen? Hopefully some of you will start to believe me. Next on the docket. Yes, that's right. According to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, you have no privacy in the contents of your phone. Listen to this. Now, a federal appeals court ruled that the constitutional right against self-incrimination doesn't prevent California police from forcing a suspected drug dealer from unlocking his cell phone with a thumbprint. Now, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit issued a ruling in the case of Jeremy Travis Payne, and it throughout Payne's constitutional challenges to the admissibility of evidence collected after Highway Patrol forced Payne to unlock his phone. Now, the court said in the ruling that Payne's case was pretty simple, but it does not mean that police are entitled to force individuals to unlock electronic devices in all circumstances. Rather, the court said this matter comes down to what kind of thought process would be required for unlocking and the surrounding facts, including the whether the person permitted to choose which finger to use to unlock the phone. That can make all the difference, apparently. Now, Payne's case is a little distinguishable from the everyday person because he was on felony parole as it relates to an assault with a deadly weapon back in 2018, where he was sent to prison and then, like I said, released on parole. As a condition of his parole, Payne was required to sign documents agreeing that he would cooperate with various kinds of searches if allowed, if asked to do so. So while on parole, Payne was arrested and charged with possession with intent to distribute fentanyl and cocaine. Now, during a traffic stop, the officers forced Payne to unlock his cell phone using his thumbprint. Now, once the phone was unlocked, officers found several videos showing Payne inside a room filled with pills suspected to be fentanyl and money counting machines. Now, officers also found a map which dropped pins that led them to locations captured in the video where they indeed found drugs. Payne raised both Fourth and Fifth Amendment challenges to the officer's compelling use of his thumbprint. Now, the district court denied Payne's motion to suppress evidence on both constitutional grounds. Payne then pled guilty and was sentenced to 12 years in prison. That's what they refer to as a conditional plea in federal court. You can plead guilty, but you still are allowed to raise your issues on appeal. So Payne did this. He appealed to the Ninth Circuit, and Judge Talman wrote the opinion, but it was unanimous, a three-judge panel. Now, Talman dispensed with the Fourth Amendment claim on the basis that Payne's status as a parolee subjected him to significantly diminished expectations of privacy. Now, I kind of get that, because when you're a parolee, your parole officer can show up anytime you want and say, let me look at your phone, let me search your apartment. But that's the parole officer. Normally, the police can't have a parole officer do what they wouldn't legally be required to do themselves. Here we go. So the judge pointed out that Payne signed these agreements that required him to surrender any device for search warrants without cause. The panel ruled that although Payne's parole condition did not specifically not require him to provide a biometric identifier, the cell phone unlocking was a significant enough departure from the condition to which he agreed to warrant suppressing the evidence. But the judge said the Fifth Amendment claim rested on whether compelled use of the thumb unlock feature was testimonial. That's significant because if it's testimonial, and testimonial means under Supreme Court case law that it is intended to be used in court, that it has to, you have to bring the person in and they have to be subject to cross-examination, okay? And they concluded that it was not. Therefore, the Fifth Amendment didn't prohibit the officer's compelled use of the unlock in Payne's case. They said compelled physical acts, i.e. those that require an individual to serve as a donor, they're not testimonial in nature. And he said, hey, this is nothing more like a blood draw, or the court ordering that a fingerprint be taken. Rather than constitutional testimony for the purposes of Fifth Amendment, those actions require no cognitive exertion and merely compelled an individual to provide law enforcement with access to an immutable physical characteristic. Now, the court did say, hey, don't get us wrong, this shouldn't be read too broadly. And they said, hey, we'd be remiss not to mention that Fifth Amendment questions like this one are highly fact dependent, and that the line between what is testimonial and what is not testimonial is a particularly fine one. And the court said, hey, our opinion should not be read to extend to all instances where a biometric is used to unlock an electronic device. And the court concluded that self-incrimination analysis by explaining that seemingly minor facts, such as whether a person could choose the finger used to unlock the device, could have a significant effect on the legality of the underlying police action. So, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, normally, and I've seen it done, have just case just recently. If they can't get into your phone, they have to get a warrant to crack the code on your phone. It's this proprietary software that is not given to general use. It's called Gray Key. Defense attorneys can't buy it. The only people who get it are law enforcement and government officials. That's it. They stick it in there. It was created to get around being unable to unlock an iPhone because Apple wouldn't cooperate. So they did that. You have to get a warrant. But now they're saying, hey, I mean, why not just hold it up on facial recognition? Boom, we have access to the phone and we're in. I mean, that's practical. You still got to get a warrant, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, the Supreme Court has said in the Carpenter case, you have an expectation of privacy in your phone. Hopefully, the Supreme Court will take this up. And not because, you know, we want criminals to get away with stuff, ladies and gentlemen. Because although the court says, hey, don't read this too broadly, you should just assume that it will be read broadly. And officers and prosecutors will say, it's all reasonable. We weren't doing anything we couldn't get a warrant for. And we just, you know, held the phone up to their face. Or we put his finger on the little biometric holder or placeholder so that we could get his finger and unlocked. It was a miracle. Judge, what's the big deal? And although this case involved somebody that was on parole, I guarantee you the next one won't be. So just like the Crumley case, someone will rely upon it and says, Judge, this is completely, completely reasonable, not in violation of anyone's Fourth Amendment. Trust me. Don't doubt me, ladies and gentlemen. Next, guy who poisoned his wife loses on appeal. Christina Harris was found dead by her neighbor. Harris's cause of death was initially ruled accidental by medical examiners after a blood sample tested positive for opioids. But her family was quite adamant that Christina didn't use drugs, and the family insisted that they should go test the frozen breast milk in the refrigerator or freezer to prove it, because Harris was still breastfeeding, an infant at the time. Guess what? The police did that. They ultimately arrested her husband, Jason Harris, for poisoning his wife's cereal. Well, he lost, went to prison for the rest of his life, and he has lost his appeal, and I'm okay with that. And next on the docket, our dumb criminal of the day. And when you know they're dumb when they say, well, doing so would be dumb, and well, that's how you go to jail. I know, it's almost silly that somebody would do that, right? So take a listen to this. A Florida couple tried to claim to lottery officials that a, wait for it, taped together scratch-off ticket was worth $1 million. Should we see how that worked out? So according to the arrest affidavit, Kira Lee Enders, on March 1st, went to the Florida Lottery's office, which is located in Pensacola, Florida, and claimed that she won the $1 million prize from the 500X cash scratch-off ticket. The ticket appeared to have some obvious alterations and was crudely pieced together from two separate tickets. Is it starting to come to mind how stupid this woman is? Needless to say, the lottery officials didn't honor the ticket, but they contacted the police. So the deputies allege that Enders ripped the two tickets, which were non-winners, and put them together to make it look like she had a winning ticket. She wrote her full name and address on the ticket and signed it under penalty of perjury because, you know, you don't want that winning ticket to fall into somebody else's hands and then steal the money. That'd be horrific. Anyway, so they started investigating the case, and the detectives got involved. And agents and deputies called in Ms. Enders and her boyfriend, a guy by the name of Dakota Jones, for an interview. Now, the police immediately detained the pair when they arrived and separated them for questioning. Now, Ms. Enders allegedly told police that she realized she had the winner when she scratched off the ticket at her home, but couldn't remember exactly where she bought that ticket from. She then tried three different businesses to try to say that they'd scanned the ticket, but was unsuccessful. She planned on sharing the winnings with Mr. Jones. Now, detectives then asked her how the ticket got ripped, and she claimed It had gotten wet in the rain, and she tried to scratch it off before it got too dry. She then allegedly stated that she just simply taped the ticket together by herself, because who wouldn't do that, right? Anyway, then the detectives confronted her with the truth that the ticket allegedly was a non-winning ticket made into the winning ticket. What? They don't go together? She acts as surprised. Now, the Miss Enders continued to insist that the two pieces of the ticket went together and that she did not intentionally commit fraud, because doing so, that would be dumb, and that's how you could go to jail. Miss Enders also claimed that her boyfriend had nothing to do with the fake ticket. So, the police then went over and interviewed Mr. Jones. What do you think he said? Well, he thinks that Enders bought the ticket at a Winn-Dixie near their house, and they got wet, so they took a blow dryer to dry the ticket. The Jones advised that he then told Enders that she shouldn't have put tape on the ticket because it looks like she altered it. Duh. Jones then stated that Enders stated that they weren't going to accept the ticket because it looks jank, but the front desk told them that a damaged ticket takes longer because it has to go through security. So Jones stated that they are all honest people and they are not into doing fraud. But Jones then allegedly maybe changed his story. Why? Because the threat of imminent incarceration tends to break the bonds of loyalty, ladies and gentlemen. And Mr. Jones said he and Miss Enders were walking near their house when they saw half of a torn ticket on the ground and then walked about 50 yards and found the other half. They taped it together and it appeared that they had won $1 million. Mr. Jones also allegedly said that neither he nor Miss Enders play the lottery very often, which contradicted what his girlfriend had told the detectives. Anyway, when the police went back to Miss Enders to tell her what her boyfriend had told them, and that it was a completely different story about how they obtained the tickets, well, then she allegedly continued to insist that she bought the ticket. Needless to say, both Mr. Jones and Miss Enders were arrested on charges of forgery, altering of a lottery ticket with the intent to defraud, grand theft in the amount greater than $100,000 or more. They have May 10th for a court date. I hope their luck continues. I mean, after all, they won $1 million. Come on. Who doesn't tape a couple of tickets together and claim they're worth $1 million? Who knew it was that easy to win the lottery? All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's all we have for you today. Thanks for watching. Hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you next time. And yes, the Constitution matters.